It's Monday, July 20th, 2026, and it's got to be 420 somewhere in the world. I'm your host, Radical Russ Belville, your patriotic progressive red state refugee, and welcome to the Radical Russ Show, coming to you from Rolla J Studios in Southern Oregon. On this week's Smoke Session, let's talk about the life and death of Lindsey Graham, Lorenzo Salgado Arujo, and Juan Sebastian Guerrero, the campaign of Graham Plattner, the appeals of Donald Trump in the E. Jean Carroll case, and the Democrats' chances of winning in 2026 if they don't start changing their messaging. We'll also talk about the life and death of trans girl May Pollard in the state of Idaho. And we conclude with the life and death of my father, the Rockin' Johnny B. But before we get to all the serious life and death stuff, we've got time for three quick hits.
You don't want to miss your stupid soccer game, asshole.
Incredible soccer!
Who wants to coach the soccer team and help out with the science fair?
First of all, it's not a stupid soccer issue, and you're a jerk.
So congratulations to España for winning the World Cup soccer tournament in the United States. It was just really great to see. Of course, the Trump sports curse is in effect. He was getting all friendly and cheering for Argentina. Lionel Messi, the so-called greatest player in the world, was held scoreless. Mbappe from France ends up getting the golden boot. And at the very end, of course, you saw this where all the players from Spain are on the podium waiting to hoist the trophy and take the big group picture. And there's senile Satan, old grandpa, waddling across the front of the stage like it's all about him. And then standing off to the side there, trying to be in the picture. He's photobombing the damn picture. Gianni Infantino, the head of FIFA, comes strolling across the stage to try to, hey, come on now. Let's go on, Grandpa. Let's go on. They couldn't get him off the stage. The Spanish team ends up photoshopping him out of the picture. They had to actually crop him out of the picture and Photoshop over it, because he, again, thinks it's all about him. And how beautiful was it to see him there at that World Cup to get so soundly booed? And they tried turning the music up there in the stadium to cover it up, but it didn't really work. Nobody likes you. But as I watched this World Cup, I did have to complain a bunch about soccer. There needs to be some fix to football, both the soccer and the American football. And I've got a few ideas. First of all, what is this thing where you play for 90 minutes and then it's all tied and you go to extra time and someone scores and the game's not over? You keep playing? No. Turn that into sudden death. What is up with this continue playing stuff? If you ran around for 90 minutes and you ran up to a tie, the next guy that scores wins. That's the way it should be. Don't settle this with five penalty kicks at the end because you let them tie up again. Settle it with sudden death and make the sudden death interesting. When you go into extra time, at the 3-minute mark of extra time, pull a guy off the field for each team. So it's 10 on 10. And then the next 3 minutes, pull another guy. It's 9-on-9. The next 3 minutes, pull another guy. It's 8-on-8. So that by the time you get to the half hour mark, if they're still running around kicking that ball, it's goalie versus goalie. Let's get this damn thing over with, shall we? And one other thing, the penalty kicks. So what's this deal with the penalty kicks? I watched the France-England third place game, which was a ton of fun. A 6-4 score. Wow, scoring. They really have Americanized this game. But one of the penalties, there was the guy was all running by himself, has the ball. He's amongst three or four defenders there in the box. And then there's he's tripped or whatever. I forget exactly how it came down, but there's a penalty. And so the remedy for being amongst a bunch of guys actively playing, four or five of them around you, where you might have had a 10 or 15 or 20% chance of scoring, the remedy for that is to set this guy up on the line against the goalie, just him and the goalie, a shot that I looked up the statistic, a shot that's 80% guaranteed to go in, the penalty for the 20% chance you were taken, the 20% chance that was taken away from you, the penalty for that is you get an 80% chance. At least the NBA makes you shoot two free throws that generally have an 80% chance of going in. So that doesn't seem fair to me. That seems to be quite unjust. If you ask me, here's how you change the penalty kick thing. Go ahead and let the guy free kick from the line, but not the box line. Put him back at midfield. And no goalie, right? You kick from midfield, like a field goal. You kick from midfield. If you can kick it into the goal, then there's your penalty kick. I mean, why not? Seems a little more fair to me. But the other thing that has come out of this World Cup is that World Cup soccer has to be played on grass. So they played in all these American football stadiums, you know, in Kansas City and New York, New Jersey, and so forth, Dallas, where they have turf sometimes. But they rolled out all this grass for the soccer players to play. And so American football players, which should be called tackle ball, by the way, American tackle ball players, are like, why can't we have grass? Because artificial turf is terrible for their feet and their legs. It causes more injuries. It's just awful, right? They would rather play on grass. So let's make that happen, NFL. Put tackle ball games on grass. You've proven that you can do it. Furthermore, oh, well, we can't have the grass because, you know, of our indoor stadiums. Yeah, get rid of the indoor stadiums, too. Tackle ball should be played outside in the elements. That's what home field advantage is all about. That's why you got the frozen tundra in Green Bay. That's why you got a swampy situation down in Miami. Everybody's got their own home field advantage based on the weather. Play outside on the grass. And you want to go real old school? Put them back in leather helmets with no face masks. Yeah, people gasp at what? Leather helmets. Huh? That's insane. But you notice they don't have the same problems with chronic traumatic encephalopathy and dying of ALS at four times the rate of a normal person in rugby. Don't seem to have that problem in rugby or Australian rules football where they're not wearing helmets. The helmet is the problem. It gives you the false sense of security. The fact that we actually have a penalty in college and pro called targeting, where you're leading with your head as a weapon, is kind of the clue there. Take the helmet away. People will get back to good tackling and good form. And believe me, you'll see fewer concussions. You'll see less of this CTE and the ALS and all of that. It seems counterintuitive, but it would work. And there's been studies proving it. Oh, and the other thing we need to get back to tackle ball. 20th century kicking rules. This whole mucking around with the safety of the kicking game has really been a blight on the strategy in kicking, right? Like, there are no more surprise onside kicks. You can't do a surprise onside kick because the way they have to line up now and you have to declare that it's going to be an onside kick. Well, that part of the success of onside kicking is when it's a surprise. Same thing with the surprise two-point conversion. Used to be, you know, you kick for a extra point, you could fake it and go for a two-pointer. Well, you can't now because the extra point has to be lined up back at 15, but the two-point conversion has to be lined up at the, what, two or three, whatever it is. And one in college, two in college, three in pro, three in college, whatever it is. Get rid of that. Go back to the old kicking rules where we can have surprises.
You can do what you want to us, but we're not going to sit here and listen to you badmouth the United States of America. Gentlemen!
Now it's time for our regular look at technology upgrades around the world in a segment we call Meanwhile, Here in the USA.
And I'm proud to be an American, where at least I know I'm free.
China just got a heliostat plant, a concentrated solar power station using a large field of computer-controlled mirrors to reflect the sun onto a tall central tower to power 170,000 homes a year and save 130,000 tons of CO2. Meanwhile, here in the USA, you can get dill pickle-flavored Cheetos.
And I'm proud to be an American, where at least I know I'm free.
Japan has perfected a revolutionary process to extract lithium from dead batteries with a 90% recovery rate. The brilliant technological leap guarantees Japan's absolute economic security. Meanwhile, here in the USA, in a few states, you'll pay a nickel or a dime for every aluminum can in your grocery purchase that you can then get refunded if you take the time to collect them all without crushing them so they can be run through some barcode reader and credit those nickels and dimes back to you.
That I'm proud to be an American, where it means I know I'm free.
Cuba becomes the first country in the world to invent a lung cancer vaccine, despite decades of sanctions and blockades from the United States. Meanwhile, here in the USA, we've brought back measles.
That I'm proud to be an American, where it means I know I'm free.
Pakistan's farmers bought so many solar panels that the country's grid electricity demand fell for the first time in history, an unprecedented event for a developing country with a growing population and economy, where electricity demand virtually always rises. Meanwhile, in the USA, we're encouraging our farmers to grow more corn to turn into biofuels to keep powering our internal combustion engines.
How many signatures does he need to get on the ballot?
Simply by registering for the ballot.
The standard is whether or not the intent of the voter is reflected by the ballot.
That the literature of the ballot has attracted so much more attention than the music.
Oh, yes, there's the country baseline. That means we've got a quick update on our Boycott Idaho segment. Just real quickly here, I've been telling you about the Idaho Medical Marijuana Act for 2022. Really excited that the Natural Medicine Alliance of Idaho put this campaign together with paid signature gatherers and a professional staff and gathered over 150,000 signatures to turn into the Secretary of State's office, only needing 75,000 valid ones to make the ballot. And as I had mentioned on my previous podcast, one of the ways you could honor my dad's legacy, having been the chief petitioner for the 2020 effort, was to vote for this 2022 effort and finally make his medical marijuana legal. Well, you won't get the chance. Secretary of State's office announced that the Idaho Medical Marijuana Act for 2022 failed to make the ballot. After turning in 150,000 signatures, only 63,000 were valid, a validity rate of 42%. Now, when I was running the medical marijuana campaign back then in 2020 and working on it in 2018 and 2016, we were told by professionals that if you had professional signature gatherers, you could get your validity rate up to 60 or 65%, which is what you would need to be able to make the ballot. Apparently that did not work out for the campaigners in Idaho. 42% is a pathetic turnout. And it sounds to me as if the signature gatherers were not very well trained. This is something that we had to go over quite a bit in our campaigns. And that is that an invalid signature is worse than getting no signature at all. Because when you get an invalid signature, you get a signature from someone who's not registered to vote, or they're signing on the wrong county sheet, or they're putting in their incorrect address, or their signature doesn't match the signature on their voter registration file. All sorts of ways it can be invalid. If that person signs an invalid signature, they think they've signed the petition. So they're not going to bother to re-sign it sometime later after they are a registered voter. You've lost yourself a potential signature when you get a signature on the ballot that's not valid. And you fooled yourself into thinking you've got more signatures than you have in that particular district, and you move on to a different district. Which, again, in Idaho, you have to collect not just a statewide signature goal, you also have to collect a district signature goal in at least 18 of the 35 districts, and they only made their target in 12 districts. So a pretty shoddy job of trying to get medical marijuana on the ballot in the state of Idaho, and maybe you could forgive that. Maybe you could think, well, you know, it's Idaho, it's a red state, it's tough to get signatures on something so liberal, so progressive. You know, people are sick of the issue. They think it can't be done. Those excuses might work if not for the fact that another group Idahoans United for Families, I think they're called, Children and Families, something like that, managed to get their abortion rights initiative on the ballot. The Secretary of State announced that with 105,000 signatures submitted, they made the ballot. Idaho medical marijuana had 150,000, didn't make the ballot. These guys turned in 105. They made the ballot. They got at least 75,000 signatures statewide. They got at least 6% of the signatures from 18 out of 35 of the legislative districts. That's a 71% validity rate when 60 or 65% is considered good. So Idaho abortion rights made the ballot. A few years back, the Idaho Medicaid expansion made the ballot. It does seem like progressive issues can make the ballot in this red state if the campaigners provide a professional campaign to gather those signatures. It just might be that Idaho will never legalize marijuana in any form.
Our top story tonight.
Our top story tonight.
Our top story tonight.
Our top story tonight.
The Grim Reaper.
Oh, by the way, have you seen the Grim Reaper?
I never imagined that the Grim Reaper would be so ugly.
Sit around waiting for the Grim Reaper to come and put us all out of our misery.
The Grim Reaper.
Well, we have a lot of death to talk about on today's podcast. We'll start off with the untimely sudden death of Senator Lindsey Graham of South Carolina, who passed away on Sunday from arterial sclerosis. His heart literally exploded. So the metaphor department in the writer's room is working overtime here for the hard-hearted senator to die from an exploding heart. Sad for his family, sad for the people who loved him, but not sad for our country. Lindsey Graham was a spineless, craven opportunist who sucked up to whatever power center there was in the Republican Party. When that was John McCain, he sidled up to John McCain. And when John McCain wasn't useful to him anymore, he betrayed his legacy and sidled up to Donald Trump, even after accurately noting in 2015 that if they nominated Trump, they would get destroyed and they would deserve it. He regularly called Trump out as being a fraud and a con man and a criminal until it became clear that Trump was going to be in power. And then Lindsey Graham became his best buddy. And the irony of Graham dying that night, apparently he was scheduled to go on Meet the Press the next day on Sunday. And the night before was not feeling so well and had joked, well, I can't die yet. I've still got to fix this Iran thing in the Middle East. And you know, talk about a bucket list. My goodness. But yeah, Lindsey Graham suddenly died. But Mitch McConnell, we don't know about Mitch McConnell. So Mitch McConnell's been out of the limelight for about a month now. There's reports that he had been taken away by ambulance from his home, an ambulance and EMTs that weren't in any sort of rush when they were taking him away from the home, that didn't use their lights, leading everyone to wonder whether or not Mitch McConnell was still alive. And finally, they released a proof of life photo because the governor there in Kentucky, Andy Beshear, a Democrat, has been wondering just where's Mitch? Are the people of Kentucky being even represented? Is he alive at this point? And in Kentucky, they've got a deal where under the state constitution, the governor can name a replacement for a senator who has died or become incapacitated. But the deadline for such a thing to happen would be April 13th, because the Republican legislature went and passed a law as soon as a Democrat got into power, of course. They started passing all sorts of laws to take the power away from the governor's office. And that's one power they took away, is they made it so that the governor couldn't appoint a replacement. It had to be done through a special election that had to be called by August 13th. So the theory of the case here is that they are hiding the death or incapacitation of Mitch McConnell so that it'll get beyond August 13th and he can't be replaced. And there's still some question as to the constitutionality of the law that they passed that takes away the power of the governor to appoint a replacement. So what we're all wondering out here is, what are you waiting for, governor? Like, what would Mitch McConnell do in this same exact circumstance if he were governor? He would be making the appointment. He would appoint a new senator for the state of Kentucky and send them to D.C. and dare the Senate not to seat him. Dare the Republicans to complain in Kentucky that they passed a law. Sue to have to take that to the Kentucky Supreme Court to determine whether or not that's an even valid law. Mitch McConnell would be making some political pressure out of this instead of what Beshear is doing, which seems to be just like, well, please show us that you're alive, okay? Please? Won't you please send us some proof of life? And the proof of life photo they sent, oh my God. Does anybody believe this thing? It's him and his wife, by the way, whose wife, Elaine Chao, who was a cabinet administration official in a couple Republican administrations, Secretary of Labor, I believe it was. Elaine Chao goes and flies off to China 3 days after Mitch is taken into the hospital. Her explanation is, well, there wasn't really anything with his health that could have been taken care of with her there, and she'd already planned to go. But she's out there meeting with the Chinese vice president. For what? For what reasons? Talking about the rapidly vanishing Senate lead for the Republicans, perhaps? No, force him to do a video. And they've got these Scott Jennings and others that say, oh, yeah, I got on the phone with Mitch, talked to him for 20 minutes. Yeah, he's doing great. We talked about Iran. We talked about taxes. Oh, yeah, Mitch is just fine. Have him call somebody who's not in the tank for him, calling Scott Jennings and other Republicans. Have him call live into Jake Tapper on CNN, a live phone call. There's so many easy ways they could prove Mitch McConnell is still alive and with us. The fact that they're not doing it leaves with a whole bunch of questions and suspicions. They're not down just Lindsey Graham, but they're down two senators at this point. Other political news I wanted to get to at the top of this podcast, two more deaths from marauding. What are they? The Combat Unidentified Marauding Federal Ethnic Cleansing Extermination Squads. They're not ICE, they're cum feces. Combat Unidentified Marauding Federal Ethnic Cleansing Extermination Services. Killed two men, one in Maine, one in Texas. Their names, Lorenzo Salgado Araujo and Joan Sebastian Guerrero. Same story, shot in their cars. ICE claims the vehicles were weaponized, which is ICE speak for we were standing beside a vehicle when it started to move. And the evidence is showing that they were shot through the side, not through the front windshield as if you would when you were about to get run over. No, they're shot from the side again, like Renee Good. Another man died after being chased on foot, ran out in the street, and got hit by a truck. 11 people across the United States have died in these ICE encounters, including Renee Good and Alex Pretty, and these two men. And yet the reporting on this leaves something to be desired. I mean, imagine if there were a serial killer loose in the United States who'd claimed 11 victims across multiple states. You'd hear nothing about that, but about that serial killer every night on the news. Be safe. There's a serial killer on the loose. Here's what to do to protect yourself from the serial killer. And yet, we're paying these serial killers, these masked, unidentified, and according to the reports that we're getting from the ex-wife, two of the ex-wives of one of these guys, one of these killers, oh, yeah, he beat me all the time. He was awful. He was abusive. The kind of things that they check as qualifications when you're signing up for ICE, I guess. All of these wife-beating incel chuds running around our streets, masked with impunity, and now the word coming down that the FBI will no longer be investigating any of these things. Nope, it'll all be internal investigations by DHS and ICE. No need for the FBI to take a look at it and, you know, uncover evidence and such. These federal ethnic cleansing death squads are going to get worse. They're going to be stationed outside of our polling places, the drop boxes. They're going to be there in minority neighborhoods to intimidate. More people are going to die because of this. And the people who brought this upon us, the officials, the Republicans who voted for it, need to be held to account. And yet, I see some of the leading Democrats out there don't seem to understand the assignment. I saw a post come out from Representative Kathy Castor. This little celebratory post about the World Cup and soccer and how she's happy to be part of the bipartisan Congressional Soccer Caucus with these other Republicans to promote soccer. There's people being murdered in our streets by our government, and you want me to get excited about your little bipartisan soccer caucus? This is what we're upset about. This is in that editorial, the Broom the Soup that I did a couple podcasts ago. We're sick of this. We're sick of Republicans who actively work against us, who actively fight us, who depress our wages, who kill us in the streets, who take away our public safety. We've got diarrhea lettuce out there and particulates in the air and bad water and lacking vaccines and destroying our economy and replacing us with AI. We're sick of those guys, the Republicans that do that, that destroy America for the benefit of a small, very few. But we're also sick of the Democrats who come after them, who clean things up a little bit. I'll give them that credit. They do tend to rescue the economy and fix things a little bit. But never hold those Republicans to account who abused us for the time prior. Allow them to regroup, regrow, continue to plan their domination, their fascism, their destruction of American democracy. They take us three steps back. Democrats get into office, move one step forward, and allow them to be there the next time to take us another three steps back. We don't want bipartisan compromise. We don't want reaching across the aisle. We don't want working with our Republican colleagues. I saw James Tallarico, who's down there in Texas, who's doing a great job. He's campaigning, you know, Paxson's trying to claim he's not Texan enough. He's saying, I'm an eighth generation Texan. That's all fine and good. But then the clip goes on and he starts talking about how Texans want a senator who will bring Democrats and Republicans together to solve problems. Bullshit. We don't want to bring Democrats and Republicans together. Republicans are the ones who hate us and want to kill us. Republicans are the ones that want to take our jobs and money and funnel them to the 1%. They are the enemy. Start treating them that way. Who is the James Tallarico after Nazi Germany? How about, or Pete Buttigieg? I saw Pete Buttigieg's clip the other day where Buttigieg was talking about the people that had voted for Trump three times and how there were good people. There were good people that voted for Trump, and they feel like Democrats hate them. They feel like Democrats don't like them. They hate their culture, and we need to find a way to work with those Trump voters and bring them in and show those Trump voters that we don't hate them. When we bullshit. Good people voted for Trump? Maybe in 2016, some good people voted for Trump. Perhaps some good people voted in 2020. But after the insurrection, after he sat there for 3 hours and let cops get beaten and sprayed and did nothing to stop it, after the stop the steal, after they're eating the cats, they're eating the dogs, after being forced to pay out over $5 million plus interest to E. Jean Carroll because he raped her in a department store and lied about it? No, no. After all that's come out about Donald Trump, after all the 10 years we've seen of Donald Trump, you cannot be a good person and have voted for Donald Trump. I'm sorry, Pete Buttigieg. When I hear you guys, Tallarico, oh, we need to bring Democrats and Republicans together. Buttigieg, oh, we need to find a way for them not to hate us. I wonder, who were you in Germany in 1948? We need to find a way to work with the people that voted for the Nazis. We need to find out why they thought the Nazis were a good party to vote for. What were their concerns? What concerns did the Nazis address? No! No! In 1948, we shamed the people that had voted for the Nazis. We forced them to have to walk through the concentration camps to see what their votes had wrought, what their support had led to. We had to make them understand the evil that they supported. Germany banned the swastika, banned the Nazi Party, made it clear that this was a blight on its thousands of years of history that should never be repeated, that should always be taught to future generations so the mistake is never made again. Pete Buttigieg and James Tallarico were in Germany in 1948. They'd be signing up Nazis to be, ex-Nazis to be part of the new government, working with the old Nazis to find out how we can come up with a tax credit for something. Give me a break. Democrats, you got to do better. You got to understand the assignment that you understand. And the assignment is accountability is job one. We want to see the fuckers who ruined our country, who hate America and Americans. We want to see them pay. We want to see their voters shamed. We want to see them understand they made a huge mistake. They are anti-American and they need to join us. They need to come to our side. The Overton window has shifted far enough to the right. It's time to get back to FDR socialism. It's time to get back to we the people. It's time to get back to a more perfect union and promoting the general welfare and securing the blessings of liberty. You know, American shit. One other clip that I saw was the confirmation hearings. They had Todd Blanche for attorney general, and I can't remember the guy for DNI. Can't remember his name. But anyway, they had the director of national intelligence nominee up there being asked various questions. And John Ossoff got some viral moment from doing a basic job of journalism, you know, asking a question and not letting someone dodge it. You may have heard the clip already. I'm not going to play it again, but it's basically Ossoff says, who won the 2020 election? The guy says, well, I'm not going to go into blah, blah, blah. Who won the 2020 election? Well, Joe Biden was certified. And he was certified because he won the 2020 election. Well, I'm not going to. Right. This whole song and dance. And Ossoff goes on to say, aren't you humiliated that you can't say who won the 2020 election? It's a simple point of fact, but you have to kowtow to Donald Trump. Right. The same game. Right. Which, and everybody's been praising this as a wonderful clip. And to a point, I agree. I agree that it's good to keep asking that question about the 2020 election and to keep having these people who want to get a Trump job deny it because they can't deny the big lie or they lose their favor with the Mad King. But it could have been better. And this is one of the problems I have with the Democrats in these hearings is they don't seem to be coordinating. I mean, they coordinated great in the January 6th hearing. Like one person would ask questions and then the next person to ask questions built on the questions before that and the next guy built on the questions before that and they built a narrative. But in these hearings, it seems like every Democratic office is just doing their own thing. So you had one or two or three of them. I think Mark Warner was another one of them that was asking, well, who won the 2020 election? Well, why is more votes? You know, like you're just rehashing the same territory. You're not building on what had gone before. So my advice to the Democrats, and I actually called Senator Wyden's office and gave him this advice. Start with 2016. Start with 2008. Start with 1980. When you ask the who won the 2020 election question, they're ready for that. You're playing in their frame. They already know what the game is. You're going to ask 2020 election. I'm going to dance around it and say that he was certified by the Electoral College. So I don't have to say he won or that he got more votes because that would make Donald Trump mad. And then you're going to call me out for that. And then we're going to go around. And for the average normie viewer out there, it's more, oh, Democrats say Trump is bad and this guy won't say Trump is bad. And they're just dancing around. But if you start that hearing by saying, sir, can you tell me who won the 1980 presidential election? What's the guy going to say? He's not going to go into his Biden song and dance, right? Well, the Electoral College certified Ronald Reagan as the winner. Blah, blah, blah. No. No, they love Ronnie, right? St. Ronnie. The conservatives guy is going to say Ronald Reagan. So then you ask him, who won the 1988 election? He's going to say George H.W. Bush. Well, who won the 1992 election? Well, Bill Clinton. Who won the 2000 election? George W. Bush. And with the 2000 election, if you get them to say George W. Bush, you've gotten them to say the truth of who won an election that was in doubt, that had controversy about it. So you've taken away that little plank of their 2020 defense that, oh, it was unsure, there was shenanigans, there might have been voter fraud. Who won the 2008 election? Well, now, does he say Obama? Because he knows how much Trump hates Obama. Is he going to say Obama won the 2008 election, or is he going to dodge it? Well, if he dodges it, you've got some racism to throw onto the pile, don't you? But maybe he doesn't dodge it. He says Obama. Then you get to 2016. Who won the 2016 election? He has to say Trump. He can't not say Trump. He can't say, well, the Electoral College, well, even though Hillary Clinton got 3 million more votes, he can't, right? He has to say Trump. Then you skip 2020 and you say, who won the 2024 election? And again, he has to say Trump. So now, and maybe this isn't done by just one senator. Like I said, maybe the first senator asks about 1980 through 2000, and the second senator asks about 2008, and then the third one. But whatever, you build this little narrative. The average normie viewer who's watching this, it's turned into a game of Jeopardy. Who won the 1980 election? Oh, I know, Reagan. And they're following along as the guys are answering. So when you get to that 2020 question, and they start their little song and dance, after the audience has already watched them say quickly and accurately all these other winners of the presidential elections, even the 2000 election that had some doubt about it, even the 2016 election where it was determined by the Electoral College, now you've highlighted the absurdity of their 2020 answers. Their 2020 answers by themselves just become Democrat versus Republican. But in the shadow of answering all the other presidential elections correctly, it becomes somebody who's clearly dodging. Either they're too stupid to know who won, or they know who won and they're clearly dodging. That's what coordination could do in these hearings.
Ladies and gentlemen, an invited transgender species.
She was the first person that didn't treat me like a freak, because I'm transgender.
She is a transgender girl, David, not a terrorist.
The world urgently needs culture-changing stories about transgender people.
NBC News has a story up about the death of May Pollard in Idaho, transgender girl who took her life following the slate of anti-trans laws that have passed in the state for the past 5 to 6 years. Just a terrible, terrible story that delves into her humanity and her struggles. Going to high school where the state has passed a transgender bathroom ban. And so at her high school, there's two bathrooms where she's allowed to use. One is in the nurse's office. That's an all gender restroom. And the other one is like other side of the campus somewhere. So there's only two places where she could pee. And if she goes to either of these places, the kids at school call them the trans bathroom. So it outs her as being transgender. So rather than face that harassment, she just doesn't pee at school. She monitors her intake of food and water, starves herself, gets faint and dehydrated toward the end of the day, which is, you know, so great for a kid's learning potential, right? To avoid using the bathroom. And it's one of the hatred of gay, lesbian, bisexual, and trans people in the state of Idaho is one of the major reasons that I left the state. They've banned any sort of hormone replacement therapy, much less transition surgeries, but even hormone replacements or puberty blockers are banned. They just signed a law that went into effect this month, a trans snitch law, where if you transition at school or even ask about transitioning or even inquire about what is transgender, your teacher is a mandated reporter now who has to call the parents and say your kid is interested in transgender issues. Forced to out to the parents. The same level of mandatory reporting as if you'd have to mandatorily report finding they'd been sexually abused or beaten. Idaho treats a kid discovering their inner self the same as they treat discovering that kid had been sexually abused. So, May took her life. The interviews with the mother and the father who were distraught about this, how she had wished she could move to Oregon, where she could move somewhere to be safer. And it's just, I just don't understand. Well, I do. I do understand where the hatred comes from. It comes from superstition. It comes from religion. It comes from right-wing political voices that continue to other transgender people. I think a lot of the people that hear about this issue and think they know about this issue think they don't know trans people. And the fact is, you do. You already know some trans people. They just haven't come out to you. And you can see probably why they wouldn't, especially if you're living in Idaho. And the thing about this is, you know, growing up in Idaho, they have a saying, Idaho is what America was. And they mean that to be praise instead of what it is, that Idaho is what America was. Jim Crow, back-assward, homophobic, anti-science. Yeah, Jim. Yeah, it definitely is what America was, what the rest of us evolved out of. And they pride themselves on freedom and liberty. Bunch of freedom and liberty people. And this is where it kind of gets me, right? Because, like, how can you be a freedom and liberty person and yet at the same time pass laws to tell people the right way to dress and wear their hair? That's part of this anti-trans snitch law, is if the kid starts wearing their hair in a certain way, their clothes, dressing more feminine, asking to be called certain titles, well, that could be transgender, and so now we got to report them. Really? Like, this is what it really all comes down to, is they wish to enforce gender norms on people. Because this trans stuff doesn't cut just against trans people, it cuts against cisgender people who don't present feminine or masculine enough. What about that girl with the short cropped hair and the overalls and the waist chain to the wallet, wearing the Doc Martin boots, who doesn't wear makeup, who comes strolling into the girls' room? Who's going to call some authority? Oh my God, there's a man. There's a man in the woman's room. No, it's just a butch-looking woman. And for a place that says that you're all about freedom, why does someone not have the freedom to express themselves in a way contrary to what you think gender expression should be? I'm a cisgender heterosexual guy. But if I wanted to wear some makeup, get some breast implants, and put on a skirt, who the fuck are you to tell me I can't do that? Or that I should be treated differently because I did? Like, at what point would a boy in school be snitched out for being trans if he came to school wearing a powdered wig and some frilly overcoats and some white stocking tights? Would that be trans, or would that just be cosplaying George Washington? Like, you think you believe in freedom, but you want to dictate how men have to be men and women have to be women? And to say that this is for the safety and the privacy. Oh, no. If the trans girl goes into the girl's bathroom and then goes into that stall where the toilet is and shuts the door and sits down and pees and then comes out of that stall where other girls are standing, dressed, and she washes her hands and leaves. Oh, no. Oh, no, the privacy that's been violated for those other girls in the restroom. Yeah, break. What this comes down to is they don't believe transgender people exist. They think they're faking. They think it's a delusion. They think it's a dysphoria. They think it's a mental illness of some sort, that you're just faking it. You're a boy, but you think you're a girl, but you're really a boy. Like the transphobe in the band that I quit explained it to me. I shouldn't have to pay my tax money to fix something between you think's between your legs when it's between your ears. The problem's not between your legs, it's between your ears. So he literally said that to me. Okay. So you think the transgender person has a disorder, has a disability, has some sort of something wrong with them, that instead of them wanting to wear jeans and play football, they want to wear skirts and do macrame. That instead of being called buddy and dude, they want to be called miss and ma'am. You think that's a problem, and they ought to be forced to be called buddy and mister, and they ought to be forced to wear jeans and want to play football. They ought to be forced to do that. Ridiculous. Even if you really do think they're faking it, if you really do think it's a disorder, is it curable? Has any of this ever worked? When you found a transgender woman and you said, nope, you're a man, and we're not going to call you ma'am, and we're not going to call you she. We're going to force the teachers to call you he, him. We're going to force your workplace to not let you, I don't know, wear a skirt. Did it ever work? Did any of those transgender people go, oh, yeah, you know what? You're right. Enough of this thinking I'm a woman. I'm a man. Because all the transgender people I know seem to have found the cure. And that is living as their gender, living as they feel. It seems that when you allow them to be miss and ma'am and wear skirts and use a ladies' room, they're fine. They get along just fine. They're productive members of society. They're promoted in the military. They're leaders of companies. The only thing that ever seems to harm them is to try to force them to act and be a certain way they're not. And it's the other thing that's wild to me about the transgender thing is that we got people all around us living lives of delusion that we socially accept and respect. They're called people of faith. We got people all over the place who literally think there's an invisible man in the sky who created the entire universe and is listening to our pleas to him and will act in supernatural ways to help us. And we're supposed to respect him and take him seriously and give them days off for their special holidays and not make fun of them when they come to work with a black cross of ashes on their head, or when they need to squat down on a mat and face Mecca and pray and bow and scrape. Or when they have to cut their baby's foreskin off for no particular hygienic or sanitary or medical reason, just because that's what somebody did thousands of years ago, we're supposed to respect all that. We give them special titles like Reverend and Pastor and Father, His Holiness. And we're all just supposed to accept and respect that. All over the world, we have things called monarchies, where people believe that they had this divine right that's been passed through their bloodline, and because of that, they get to be super wealthy, and we're supposed to call them Your Majesty, Your Royal Highness. They ask for special titles and pronouns, and nobody bats an eye. Some of these religious people go and change their entire name from Cassius Clay to Muhammad Ali, or from Lew Alcindor to Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, and nobody seems to have a problem calling them their preferred names. But if Kareem wants to be Carrie, Cassius wants to be Cindy, now we got a problem. I just don't understand what that problem is. But I do. I understand. It's because they come from this hierarchical worldview where God created man superior to woman, and those men and women, they produce children to whom they are superior, and then they help form businesses where they own and they are superior to their workers, and everybody has their little slot on the organization chart, and they have to fulfill the duties required of that slot. And the duty of woman is sex object. She's there to be fucked for the pleasure of the man, and then to produce his offspring, whom she will take care of at the home, cooking and cleaning, as a good traditional wife should. And a transgender woman messes up that whole scenario. This is why you'll also notice they have a real problem with the transgender women, but don't really mention the trans men much. Because a trans woman is a man who is shedding his superiority in the heteronormative organization chart and voluntarily taking the role of sex object. That's why they don't see transgender people as people. They don't see, I should keep saying transgender women. Why they don't see transgender women as people, because they see them as men submissing themselves into being a sexual object, to being sexually receptive. And that's why they're scared of the whole bathroom and the changing room thing, the locker room thing, because it's not just some lady there who's trying to shower and get clean. It's not just some woman who wants to work out. It's not just some girl who wants to use the bathroom. It's some male pervert who slutted himself up into sissy clothing so he could get fucked like a whore. That's how they see transgender women. They see them as men faking it as part of a sexual thing. And that's why they freak out about the bathrooms. They freak out about the changing room, because how could you let these sexually freaky men who are shedding their heterosexuality and their macho dominance to become mere female sex objects? And that's why they don't have the problem with the trans men. First of all, they don't notice the trans men, because trans men pass, because testosterone's a hell of a damn drug. It really, really changes you. So most trans men pass pretty well and don't have many problems. But even if they don't pass, and you know they're a trans man, most guys aren't threatened by that, because this is a woman who has abandoned her sexual role as a sex object and is playing as a man. And that doesn't seem to bother them any. They don't worry that the transgender man is some woman there in the locker room trying to get her look at penises. They just don't, because men aren't sex objects. We're not sex objects. We are the workers and the providers. And so that fear doesn't exist. Except among gay men. Now, gay men, that's why they have the problem with gay men, is because a gay man's gaze turns a straight man into a sex object. That's why they don't like the gay men. Interesting, though, isn't it, that they don't have any crusades to ban gay men from male bathrooms or gay men from male locker rooms. Interesting, isn't it? Anyway, I'm all over the place on this rant because I'm just so mad about it. I've known 7 transgender people in my life, 6 transgender women, 1 transgender man. And one of those transgender women is just barely 19 years old, and I knew her pre-transition as a little boy growing up in Idaho. And when I see this story of Mae Pearson and I read what she went through growing up in Idaho and dealing with parents who didn't understand at first, parents that were separated and didn't understand, and how they came to learn and love and understand what was going on with their transgender daughter, they still have their parents are still not like fully on board, like they don't fully still understand, but they're reaching out with love and acceptance, trying to understand. And I think of her. I think of this girl that I've known damn near her whole life, how she survived and how she made it out of Idaho. And now, as I understand, is doing fine, thriving in Oregon. I just wish that could have been the fate for poor Mae Pollard.
Just like hearing Johnny Cash sing up Walk the Line.
As sure as night is dark and day is light, I keep you on my mind both day and night. And happiness I know proves that it's right, because you're mine, I walk the line. Because you're mine, I walk the line.
Call I've been anticipating for 24 years came in at 5:41 a.m. Pacific Time on July 7th, 2026. Russ, it's your mom. Are you on your way to work? I was. Every day I awaken at around 5 a.m., quickly dress, and get into my star-spangled Chevy Volt to drive 22 miles down the mountain into Grants Pass, Oregon. Every day I work gig apps, mostly the Spark app that provides shopping and delivery services for Walmart, Home Depot, and others. Every day I do this for 10 to 12 hours straight, with a $1 soda refill and $2 for $1 donuts left over from the day before at the AM-PM for breakfast, and a $2 Taco Bell cheesy bean and rice burrito for lunch while I'm making the deliveries. Every damn day. Because there is no paid time off, no vacation time, and no sick leave with gig apps. Because I'm burdened with way too much debt from one business disaster after another in the past decade. Because nobody is hiring guys with a Google footprint that screams pothead, who are nearing 60, and whose last W-2 job was during the Bush administration. Yeah, Mom, just heading down the mountain. What's up? I already knew what was up. Call this early from Mom can only be one thing. Well, it's your father, she began, and I really didn't follow the rest until she got to, and he's unresponsive. Dad's not been healthy. He'd had a life-threatening health scare at the turn of the century. When we threw him a 60th birthday bash in 2002, we planned it as if it could be his last. When I left for Portland, Oregon the next year, I knew someday I'd be getting this phone call and planning my pilgrimage back to Idaho for my father's last rites. But that call never came. Dad's health improved, but it was a bit of one step forward, two steps back. He'd gotten an arterial stent for his legs and regained circulation and feeling. But then he'd developed some sort of throat cancer, and they had to operate to cut it out. He'd improved his blood sugar enough to no longer be diabetic. But his kidneys were only operating at 30% efficiency. He managed to drastically reduce his use of opiate painkillers through using medical cannabis, illegal though it is in Idaho. But the damage to the nerves in his feet left him unable to play drums and made walking difficult. That was the general cycle of health news I'd receive when I'd call or visit. Mom was still talking, assuring me that everything was okay with her, that she had my eldest niece coming to help her. Now, don't you go thinking you have to come drive across the state, she was telling me. I know you've got to work to take care of Lori and the little ones. Lori is my 10-year lady love, with whom I share a 37-foot RV trailer with three tip-outs that gives us 360 square feet of living space in three rooms. We live in a mountain hideaway of Wolf Creek, Oregon, which is a small hernia of the old Highway 99 that loops off of Interstate 5 at Exit 76. It's known for the Wolf Creek Tavern that was a stagecoach stop between Portland and San Francisco, and its famous guests, such as author Jack London. Lori's a disabled grandmother and great-grandmother, whose only income is Social Security disability payments, enough to cover the cost of living 22 miles up the mountain from Grants Pass. I work to cover the cost of everything else, which, for the past 10 weeks, has also included caring for three of her great-grandchildren, ages 3.5, 2, and 6 months, because her grandson and his wife suddenly became homeless. If I work 60 to 70 hours every week, I can keep us current on all the bills. You seen how expensive baby formula is? What, are they making it with cocaine? Yeah, it's about another 90 minutes of work per week just to afford it. Did I mention the 360-square-foot trailer also houses four chihuahuas and a cat? We spoke for 3 minutes and 25 seconds. I told Mom I loved her and to keep me updated on Dad. With 15 minutes before the Walmart was to open and gig requests already coming in, I hadn't really processed what "he's unresponsive" meant in that call. I got to the AM-PM, grabbed my soda refill and last night's donuts, and then across the street to the Walmart, It was a nice morning gig, a pickup order with two deliveries. Both short distance, which was a relief, because my star-spangled Chevy Volt isn't entirely reliable. She runs fine on the plug-in electric side, which supplies me 40 miles of battery power. But when it is time to be in hybrid gas-electric mode, there's an intermittent, unpredictable, unreproducible problem with the exhaust system that gives me a warning of engine not available and propulsion power reduced, which lasts for however long I still have battery power left before the car becomes a brick. The remedy for this error, as is with many things computerized, is to turn the damn thing off and back on again, but only after waiting 5 minutes. Not three, not four, at least 5 minutes. Then you can turn the car back on and she runs fine. Almost always. This is one of the many things I took the Volt in to the mechanic to have fixed, and to his credit, many of the things were fixed, except that whole every now and then you have no engine thing. While the car was being fixed, I had to use Lori's GMC Acadia to do my work, which gets half the gas mileage. Thus, my operating costs doubled, and I took home less pay and fell further behind. But when the gas prices shot up in March, the gas costs of working in the GMC became greater than the weekly cost of paying off a service loan to fix the Volt, which figures to be about an extra 12 hours work per week through September. While I'm out delivering the orders, more of what Mom had said on the call was filtering up to my conscience. Dad fell last night? The paramedics helped him get back into bed? He was fine talking to them, lucid, but every now and then he'd say something and you'd go, "What?" Mom had explained. Oh my God, my dad is gonna die. At 7.02 a.m., there's another Walmart pickup delivery. It's headed up to Glendale, which is a couple exits farther north from Wolf Creek. I can make that delivery and stop back at home on the way to pick up clothes and toiletries for a stay back in Idaho. I'm texting with Lori the whole time. At first, I'm still entertaining the idea of working the rest of the day and staying in touch with Mom via phone. Lori, a former hospice nurse, tells me I must go and be with my mom. I protest that my car will never make it the 500-mile drive across barren eastern Oregon, and I can't take her car because she can't get the car seats in my car. Lori persists. You need to be with your mom. After leaving home, I'm running numbers in my head. The trip there and back will take 4 gas tanks. That's $140. I can crash at a friend's place in Nissa, so no hotel costs. I'm sure Mom will have something to eat, so I'm going to lose, let's see, $350 to $400 from not working on the 2 driving days across Oregon. While I'm there, I could work at the Ontario Walmart, maybe just in the early morning, maybe just $100, and then go be by Mom and Dad's side. My mind reeled. My father is lying on his deathbed, breathing his last breaths. I'm 8 hours away if my car doesn't break down on the trip. And I'm trying to figure out how to squeeze in a few extra hours of independent contracting with no benefits or job security for a multi-billion dollar corporation so that attending my father's last moments doesn't further bankrupt me. At 8:30 a.m., as I approach Grants Pass, a request comes up on another gig app, Roadie, a pickup from Tractor Supply in Grants Pass headed east of Eagle Point. That's actually exactly the route I need to go to head east across Oregon. I take the delivery for the $34 wage. It adds about an extra 20 minutes to my trip. I hope Dad holds out. The route from southern Oregon to southwestern Idaho is not a direct one. It takes you across state highways, then county roads, and even some plain old roads through some of the least populated places in the United States. From Wolf Creek, Oregon to Nampa, Idaho is scenically like driving a lifetime. You begin in young, green mountains with teeming whitewater rivers, highways lined with tall, pointy green trees backed with the occasional white mountain peak. As time and miles move by, the peaks and valleys level off. The trees a bit shorter, the hills a bit browner. Soon you're in winding roads through rocky canyons, the trees now even shorter and round, until you find yourself staring at miles of rolling hills and sagebrush that eventually give way to the irrigated fields and urban development of Idaho's Treasure Valley. As I drove those roads, I awaited another call. A call that would tell me I hadn't made it, that Dad had passed. Then there was the dread of the areas with no cell reception, not knowing if that call was trying to be made, anxiously looking for bars and incoming message alerts to tell me of the bad news I'd missed. Surprisingly, my star-spangled Chevy put in a heroic effort, not a single hiccup in 4 hours of driving. Around 12:30 p.m., I stopped at the little town of Silver Lake to get a drink and pee. I checked in for our family chat. My eldest niece, Sam, was there along with the hospice nurses. They were getting Dad medicated with morphine. He was still with us. Next stop, Riley Sinclair. No, not my future fictional detective protagonist name. It's a gas station in the town of Riley, which is where US 395 and US 20 meet. A good halfway point to fill up on the route. But before I could get there, the Chevy had a hiccup. I had to stop in the middle of nowhere with zero cell reception and wait the 5 minutes before trying again. There, in the silence and grandeur of the wide open range somewhere in Harney County, it all hit me and I began weeping. My dad's gonna die and I might miss it. What if I miss it by the 5 minutes this car takes to reboot? Or the extra 20 minutes I added to make that $34? Or the extra hour working and then going back home instead of not just starting across the state with the clothes on my back at 5:41 a.m. when Mom first called? Thankfully, the Chevy rebooted as if there had never been a problem. We made it to Riley Sinclair, gassed up, and continued on toward Idaho. Throughout the drive, I listened to two Sirius XM stations in areas where I had cell reception. I had to give up the car subscription to save money. Willie's Roadhouse and the Elvis Channel. Dad was a musician, and the reason I am a musician. He was a touring drummer in the 60s and 70s, mostly for a country cat named Orville Couch, who had a hit in 1963 with a song called Hello Trouble.
Here comes trouble that I never thought I'd see since you went away. Well, hello, trouble. Hey, come on in. Yeah, you talk about heartaches. Where in the world you been? Well, I ain't had no miseries since you've been gone. Well, hello, trouble, trouble, trouble. Welcome home.
But he also backed folks like Dolly Parton and Johnny Cash in one-off gigs. He's even the studio drummer on some regional hit by a 60s R&B girl group he didn't even really remember, something that I would be embossing on business cards. It's weird how many classic country songs I know all the words to. Many of them are the covers Dad used to play in various bands that I heard him perform so many times that I'd memorized all the bandstand pattern bar jokes he'd throw in among them. I'd listen to those Willie Roadhouse tunes until one would make me cry too much, like For the Good Times, Ray Price's song that Dad used to use for closing. I could even remember his closing patter. It's last call, folks, and hotel motel time. You don't have to go home, but you can't stay here. If you don't work here, or sleep with someone who works here, it's time to head for the doors. Then I'd flip to the Elvis Channel. Oh, Dad loved the King. Dad was 12 years old when Elvis hit the scene. Until that time, music had been more standard sort of fare under the tutelage of his mom, my grandma Grace. She had been a trained opera singer and taught Dad how to sing harmonies as a child. So when Elvis hit, that's when Dad knew he was going to be a rock and roller. He took up drums in school, began playing in bands, and continued to do so until health problems at the end of the 20th century took the feeling in his feet.
Train to rock. 16 coaches long. Train to ride. 16 coaches long. Well, that long black train got my baby gone. Yes, gone.
I drove with Elvis and Willie until we hit the no reception zone. Then I fired up my podcast from just 8 days prior, featuring the interview with my parents from 3 days before that. We were just talking less than 2 weeks ago. Now that interview is the last recording I have of my father. And what a good one it is. One thing he said that kept me going was when he said it's all about the memories when it comes to what is best in life. Since moving to Oregon in 2003, I hadn't been around my folks as much as I'd like. My career and my marriage made visitation difficult. I missed not only them, but also my nieces growing up. Since my divorce and my relationship with Lori, I've been trying to make more of those memories. As I drove, I recalled the times we shared in the past decade while trying not to speed too much. Is 80 miles an hour too much? And telepathically telling Dad to hold on, I'm on the way. In 2016, Mom and Dad had their 50th wedding anniversary. I got myself ordained as a minister and my folks renewed their wedding vows. There was also a Boise Hemp Fest where they came to see me speak. Despite some reticence in 2005 when their oldest boy began working in medical marijuana activism in Portland, by 2016, Mom and Dad had come to fully recognize the righteousness of my cause. In 2017, Lori and I and Mom and Dad went to Las Vegas to watch our beloved Boise State Broncos defeat the Oregon Ducks in the Las Vegas Bowl. We also took some time to go to an indoor range and shoot machine guns. In 2018, Lori and I had moved to Ontario, Oregon, on the border with Idaho, and Dad is getting more involved with our medical marijuana campaigns there. He's thrilled to discover that Democratic gubernatorial candidate Pauline Jordan was supportive of medical marijuana, alluding to her Native American heritage and their culture's support of herbal medicines. In 2019, after the 2018 medical marijuana campaign failed, I told Dad he'd be a great chief petitioner. A recovered drug and alcohol addict who became drug counselor, retired by chronic pain, who's an elderly third-generation Idahoan who loves to hunt and fish? Well, he agreed and became a part of history. The 2020 Idaho Medical Marijuana Act that was derailed by COVID. That 2020 medical marijuana campaign in Idaho will always be special to me. Dad and I planned a series of stops over 7 weekend road trips such that we could say we collected signatures from every county seat in the state of Idaho. There are 44 counties in Idaho, and the state measures 479 miles north to south and 305 miles east to west, with a whole bunch of mountains and rivers in between. We traveled together in my 2012 six-speed manual Honda Civic Si, which wasn't the most comfortable rig for him to sit in for hours, but he endured, regaling me with all manner of stories about the various places we were passing by in Idaho. At least 15% of what he told me was based in reality. See that? The town of Athol, named after the mayor of the place. He was a real asshole, but he had a lisp, you see. That kind of stuff. He laughed as he thought I was growing irritated by the tales. I was never irritated. I just knew they were bullshit. And in 2020, even with COVID raging, Lori and I found a way to create more memories. We brought along her teenage grandkids, and we went with Mom and Dad to a public outdoor range in Idaho and shot targets. In 2021, Lori and I are living in Ontario, Oregon, as we work on businesses in Sumter, Oregon, and Boise, Idaho. Dad wasn't leaving the house much at this point, but I made a point to visit often. Mom would make the hour drive to our backyard to help Lori with maintaining our medical cannabis garden. In 2022, it was Dad's 80th birthday, another one of those milestones nobody would have bet on. Lori and I were living that year in the same RV park as Mom and Dad in Nampa, following our business collapse in Ontario. My brother Josh drove in from Portland, where my eldest niece Sam, who lives nearby, also attended. We're dining at a buffet Dad referred to as the Golden Trough. In 2023, Lori and I have left Nampa and moved to Southern Oregon. Mom and Dad take their summer vacation to see us. Dad's still driving 500-mile road trips at age 81. We took them to this wonderful boardwalk hiking trail that leads to a vast field of carnivorous pitcher plants. Dad has always loved outdoorsy stuff, but his feet ailments made it tough for him to hike, so the boardwalk was perfect. In 2024, we didn't get to see my folks that year. Lori had to deal with successive deaths in her family back in Louisiana. I had just begun playing music professionally again after a 20-year hiatus. Dad would watch our live streams on Facebook and chime in with his opinions of the performances. 2025, it was Mom and Dad's 59th anniversary and a road trip to Portland. Yes, Dad's still driving to visit my brother Josh. Lori and I drove up to meet them and enjoy all that the Portland food truck culture has to offer. And of course, in 2026, it was Mom and Dad's 60th anniversary just 2 weeks ago. They'd planned to visit us in Southern Oregon, but Dad fell ill with anemia a couple weeks before the trip. Doctors suggested driving 500 miles probably wasn't a good idea, so just 2 weeks before the event, I rented out a Vrbo in Ontario, adding another 9 hours a month I'll have to work for the next 2 years to pay off. Roughly after 6 p.m. Mountain Time, 11 hours and 19 minutes after Mom's call, I arrived at Mom and Dad's motorhome. My niece Sam's car is parked out front. I rush into the bedroom where my dad is laying on his back. He doesn't have the oxygen tubes in his nose. He's breathing in labored, gurgling gasps. His eyes are closed, but the eyeballs are fluttering beneath. He's in there. I lay beside him on the bed, tears welling in my eyes. "I made it, Dad. I told you you should have drank some of that Flex Seal," I joked, calling back to my advice a month ago when he told me of the suspected internal bleed that had led to his anemia and to the cancellation of his 60th anniversary trip out to Southern Oregon. He knew he was going to die then. Doctors had him in the hospital, cycling through a quart or two of blood to get his counts back up. He'd been low in sodium and potassium. If they could just do a colonoscopy, they told him, they could find out where it was, and he would have none of it. He was sick of hospitals. He was sick of being cut open. He definitely was not enjoying the colonoscopy prep. "Take me home," he told Mom. All he wanted was to be at home with Mom, make it to the 60th anniversary with his family. Recently, his last and dearest friend, Beatrice, had passed suddenly from stroke. His longtime friend and bandmate, Henry, had passed 4 years prior. Aside from Willie Nelson, every musician he'd ever played with, covered, or admired had gone. He knew it was his time, and he just wanted to go out with some dignity. When we held that 60th anniversary out in the Vrbo in Ontario, we all felt it could be our last event with Dad. He loved every minute of it. It was a working horse ranch, something he had done as a young boy, so he enjoyed watching the workers put the horses through their paces. Dad grabbed a pair of drumsticks and joined me on bass and my brother Josh on acoustic guitar for some jamming in the basement, and I believe that's the first time the three of us had ever played together. While I sat with him, I held his warm, dry hand. I stroked his stubbly, bald head. I used a washcloth to pat the accumulating phlegm he couldn't swallow from his mouth and tongue. Through it all, I kept talking to him. I told him my brother Josh, his youngest son, was on the way. I told him that I was here and Sam was here and we're taking care of Mom. I told him to not be afraid and everything was going to be all right. There was a deep calm that came over me. I reflected on my entire life with him and, for the first time, saw me through his eyes. I never had any children of my own, so these 10 weeks of raising Lori's three great grandkids are the closest experience I've had. Rain, the 3.5-year-old girl, is a smart little kid like I was. Judah, the 2-year-old boy, is as energetic as I was. Yuri, the infant girl, is the same age difference as my brother Matt is from me. Dad was just shy of 26 years old when I was born and 29 when Matt was born. He was a touring road musician and midway through a raging alcohol and pill addiction. I had my own issues with drugs and music in my 20s and couldn't imagine raising two kids. Hell, I'm 58 and West Coast sober, and I am finding it difficult to handle these kids. But he did. He gave up the road life he loved and the dream of a greater music career when I began school early in 1973. It was a hectic childhood as he tried working various jobs, restaurant manager, appliance sales, mobile home sales, that had me attending a different grade school in a different town every year, kindergarten through 7th grade. I used to resent him for that. Now I see it as miraculous that he was able to keep working these day jobs and play music at night while battling full-blown addiction. Most miraculous is that I have near zero memory of my dad ever being drunk. Once, at age 10, I remember him stumbling and falling on the sidewalk outside our house. It really freaked me out. Dads don't fall. I didn't then know it to be a symptom of drunkenness. I thought he was just clumsy. Another time, around age 12, I remember him reaching way in the back of the fridge for a can of beer. We never had beer in our house, and I never saw him drinking. And I remember him admonishing me not to let Mom know he had the beer, or she'd be angry. Oh, there were the effects of him being drunk that I was aware of. He'd had a couple of rollover DUIs in the 70s, back when drinking and driving was just something you were expected to do carefully, and we had to visit him in hospital beds. I remember once asking if the fluid running into the tube poked into the vein on the top of his hand was orange juice. There were also the times he just wasn't there, out on a bender for a couple of days or a couple of weeks. Otherwise, he did a tremendous job, likely at the fierce insistence of Mom, to keep his alcoholism out of our home. So it was somewhat shocking to me at the age of 14 when he admitted himself to the Mercy Care Unit, a drug and alcohol rehab in Nampa. During my high school years, Dad was attending Boise State University, becoming president of the Student Social Workers and earning his degree in social work. He graduated college when I graduated high school in 1985. It's amazing to me that he went back to school after 40. He went on to work with developmentally disabled people for 9 years before joining the staff at Mercy Care Unit as a drug and alcohol rehab counselor. He helped hundreds, maybe thousands of people get clean and sober in the years he worked there before illness left him too disabled to work. I told Dad how proud I was of him for all he had overcome, that I forgave him for any shortcomings he might have felt he had as a father. I told him how much I owe to him, my musical talents, my analytical mind, my dark sense of humor, my progressive principles, my silly nicknames, my terrible jokes, my love of the road. I told him I'd miss him at me and Lori's wedding this September 21st, and that I'm sad he couldn't make the third special 60th, following his birthday and anniversary, 60th birthday of his oldest son. It's closing in on 10 p.m., I left Mom and Dad there in the bed, still breathing, gurgling, eyeballs fluttering, and made the 30-minute drive to my friend's house in Nissa, just over the state line in Oregon. She showed me to the small, converted storage room she laid out for me, and I quickly fell asleep, hoping my dad was resting peacefully. I was awake, at usual, around 5 a.m. During the night, I thought about how one of those little syringe bulbs you use to clear baby mucus might be useful for helping clear Dad's mouth so he might breathe easier. I had already planned to run to the Ontario Walmart to log an hour or two of work before heading back to Nampa. If I can just work enough to cover the cost of the gas to get here and back, I thought, that should be enough. I texted Mom first. She said Dad had rested through the night and was well medicated. My brother Josh was in the chat. He was beginning his journey down Interstate 84 from Portland and should reach us by 3 p.m. Mountain. Assured Dad was still with us, I went to the Walmart, bought the little snot sucker, made a few deliveries, and got back to Dad's bedside by 7:15 a.m. He was not there. Elvis had left the building. Oh, he was still breathing in that gurgling fashion, though slower and with some pauses that would make me anxious each time, but that was just his body on autopilot. His eye sockets had completely sunken, given his face a skull-like appearance. The eyeballs, so prominent against the stretched eyelids you could make out his corneas, were absolutely frozen. Still, I laid beside him, out the snot sucker, and kept draining his mouth of phlegm as his body went through its final shutdown. Thought about whether I should call Josh to tell him, not hurry, that Dad wasn't really here. I decided against it. If he could make it here while he's still breathing, that's something, I thought. Can't take that from them. Mom and Sam were there. I helped turn Dad's body while they administered the morphine to him. Yesterday he had winced and his forehead and eyebrows wrinkled at the application. This morning he registered no reaction. Then at 10:05 a.m., Dad made one last gurgled gasp and seized up. Mom! I shouted. She and Sam rushed in. Mom took his other hand, Sam by his knees, and with us surrounding him, he was gone on day 30,741 of his amazing life. Once we gathered ourselves, Sam and I left Mom alone with Dad in the bedroom. Since she was 18 years old, she had been sleeping by his side. It was then that I realized that in this whole episode that began at 5:41 a.m. Pacific yesterday, I had not seen or heard my mom cry. "You'll have to take care of your mom," Dad had written to me in an email a few years back, contemplating his passing. "She'll try to be all Jack Morris." That's her dad, the strong, silent John Wayne type. "She'll try to be all Jack Morris about it, like it doesn't bother her, but she's going to be devastated." Well, if so, she was doing a remarkable job of not showing it. In fact, her concern wasn't for herself and her husband of 6 decades dead in the bedroom. "Do you think we should call Josh?" she asked me and Sam. I had made that Portland to Nampa trip many times, and I knew at this point he's closer to us than Portland. "Would you want to know," asked Sam, "and then have to keep driving? Or would you not want to know until you got here?" Having faced that same dilemma while rebooting the car outside Wagon Tire yesterday, I told Sam, well, me being me, I'd want to know, because I'd pull over the car at that moment to take a picture of where I was when he passed, and then probably bawl. So we called Josh. He'd just left one rest area and was miles away from the next one. He continued on and made it to Dad's bedside at 3:26 p.m. Mountain Time. Word had spread through the RV park that Dad was gone. He had many friends in this 55-plus senior community. He and Mom had become so beloved there that when the longtime caretaker finally retired, the park hired Mom on to be the caretaker in exchange for free lot rent. My brother Matt had purchased the motorhome for them, so Mom is set for housing for the foreseeable future. Hospice nurses attended to Dad's body, getting him clean and ready for transport. Dad's friend Beatrice had years earlier purchased cremation services for Mom and Dad as a gift. The facility had agreed to wait until 4 p.m., give Josh the time to be there. We were caught a bit by surprise when a Marine sergeant in dress blues showed up. It turned out that park residents had learned that my dad was a veteran, and the Marine was there to give him final honors. It's technically true, Dad's a vet. But like me, we don't make a whole lot of fuss about our service when so many others gave so much more. In my case, I was a National Guard bassoonist, keeping America safe from Cold War Soviet musicians, I guess. For Dad, he had enlisted in the Air Force as a way to keep from being drafted into the Army during Vietnam. He went through basic training and was a few months into his service when his persistent migraine headaches led to a medical discharge. The hearse showed up, but the motorhome, being as cramped as they are, meant that myself, Josh, and the funeral director had to wrap Dad's body in a sheet and haul him out of the motorhome onto the gurney and the canvas body bag that lay atop it. We zipped it up while the Marine sought out a flag to use for our ad hoc ceremony, borrowing one from one of the neighbors in the park. It was placed somewhat haphazardly over the body as the funeral director began placing it the wrong way, and the Marine had to turn it correctly. One of the hospice nurses played a recording of taps on her phone while the Marine saluted and Dad's body was loaded into the hearse. Now, as I said, I played in the Idaho National Guard's 25th Army Band and served 6 years, reaching the rank of Sergeant E5. I played in many funeral ceremonies. I could give an entire seminar on what was done wrong in this one, as some insensitive Facebook commenter did when I made the mistake of making this video a public post. But what was done right was that a community came out for a man they'd only recently come to know, and an effort was made to pay tribute to an airman who'd only given 4 months of service and never expected any tribute for that. At a time when all his close friends and colleagues had long since left him, a whole new batch of strangers were attracted to his wit and wisdom to call him friend and see him on his last farewell. When I think of one word to describe my dad, it's indelible. Which, if he were reading this aloud, he'd make a joke about being inedible. That's a good thing. My dad left his mark on people. He counseled not just drunks and addicts at work. He was often sought by my teenage friends for advice. He always had a smile and a clever line to use on folks he'd meet in the service industry. He had a real talent for the abnormal psych it took to work in drug rehab, something I should have taken advantage of much more often in navigating the relationships in my life. I'm so glad he got the last decade to see me finally content and in love with Lori. If you met my dad, you didn't tend to forget him. As the hearse drove away, I knew that he'd be in my life for the rest of it. He saw my first breath, I saw his last breath. Having never had children of my own, it's the most profound moment of my life. Rockin' Johnny B is dead. Long live the Rockin' Johnny B. You take a seat. Thanks for everything, Dad. Watch out for Mom.
And it goes down smooth. Hey!
And that's the end of this joint, my friends. The Radical Russ Show is planted, grown, harvested, trimmed, packaged, and rolled up by me, Radical Russ Belville, and governed by Creative Commons share-alike licensing. News, music, video clips, and social media posts are reproduced under fair use copyright laws for commentary and analysis. My main theme is We Love the Herb by Herbal Nation, and interstitial music is by Russ Boom Boom Belville. Which brings us to our post-credits scene. Well, with all the sports going on these days, NBA Finals, World Cup, you couldn't help but notice the proliferation of online gambling ads just everywhere. Sports Kings, FanDuel, BetMGM, everybody's got the sports betting going on, and that's not even counting the prediction markets, Polymarket, Kalshi, everybody's up to gambling, and I really had no idea how deeply this has been ingrained since the Supreme Court went and decided that online sports gambling is okie dokie. It turns out, according to a recent report, that 25% of U.S. adults gamble daily. One in four of us are gambling daily. Now, I don't know if that's just sports gambling, if they're also including lottery and all that, but wow, one in four people gambling. 42% of Americans say they overspend on their gambling. And between men aged 18 to 49, a majority of them have an active online sportsbook account with one of these apps. Oh my God. I never really got into gambling, or for that matter, video gaming. I figure, you know, that's a whole lot of time and money wasted that could be better spent on internet porn. And like George Carlin once observed, at least when I'm finished, I'll have something to show for my effort. Oh, I just don't understand this love of gambling among people out there. Now, I am a drug legalizer, as you know, and I generally am against prohibition. Criminal prohibition of gambling had all sorts of problems. You know, bookies, running the numbers, breaking your legs when you don't pay them, etc. On the other hand, when it came to legalizing marijuana, we didn't legalize it in open bins at the 7-Eleven. Yeah, we legalized it so you had to go to a store and you had to show ID, and everything in the store is highly inventoried and there's security cameras everywhere. When it comes to the proposals for legalizing other drugs like cocaine, meth, or heroin, they're never talking about like stores selling them openly. It's more like decriminalizing the possession of such things and providing safe injection facilities for people and good Samaritan laws if you call for an overdose, those kind of things. But with sports gambling, we went from the back alleys and the back rooms right to the 7-Eleven, right to your phone. It, worse than the 7-Eleven, a phone that's sending you push messages all the time to entice you to gambling. In my mind, nothing that's addictive should be advertised. The addiction is its own advertisement. The whole point of advertising is to create a need for something. You don't got to do that with drugs and gambling. The need is there. The addiction will take care of itself. And I think this for alcohol. I think this for pharmaceutical drugs. I think this for marijuana. I think this for gambling. There should be no advertising of it. The people who want it will be able to find it. You can contact me by email at radicalrus@gmail.com. Call my message line at 877-RUSS-420. That's 877-877-420. And reach me on social media on Blue Sky as radicalrus.com and nowhere else. You can support this podcast financially, or if you'd like to make donations to my widowed mom, by donating to Radical Russ on Venmo, Rad Russ on Cash App, or via PayPal on my website at RadicalRuss.com. Make sure to leave me a note that it's for my mom. Get this podcast on Spotify, Apple Music, YouTube, my website, or wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks for listening, and until next week, take care of each other.
You plant it, you grow it, you try it, you roll it, you smoke it, and it goes down.